Here we are, Mum. A library.
Oh, one of those really posh ones where they've bound all the books in the same leather so you don't know which is which. Latimer, where is the science fiction section?
There isn't one, Mum.
Oh, well, what about fantasy?
No.
Urban fantasy?
Certainly not.
Well, what are all these books?
Law books, Mum.
Wait, this is a law library? Well, that's no fun at all.
Well, that depends on what you need to get away with, Mum.
I don't suppose there's anything on removing someone from a position of power who is grossly incompetent and dangerous.
Strangely enough, Mum, they've all been checked out recently.
Oh, damn.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't been disappointed by a franchise that should have stopped after its second film. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Even though this is a law library, it still has that comforting atmosphere that only a library can provide, and conveniently, a reading area that's simply perfect for taking tea. There are lots of chairs, so make yourselves comfortable.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. David Hutchinson.
Splendid. Let's see his calling card. Dave Hutchinson. Oh, there's just his email address beneath it.
Are we to conclude that he does so many things it is impossible to list them all, or that he does nothing of note whatsoever?
He's an author, Latimer.
Oh, the latter then.
Hey, show him in.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Dave Hutchinson is the author of the Fractured Europe sequence, published by Solaris. The first in the series, Europe in Autumn, was nominated for the 2015 Arthur C. Clarke Award, the British Science Fiction Association Award, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award. The second in the series, Europe at Midnight, was nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke and British Science Fiction Awards.
Mr. David Hutchinson, Mum.
Hello, Dave. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Emma. Thanks for inviting me for tea.
Ah, you're most welcome. Would you care for a cup of tea?
I'd love a cuppa, yes, please.
And how do you take it?
I take it black with lemon and lots of sugar.
Ooh, it's been quite a while since I've had somebody who prefers lemon.
Oh, I do. I'm not a great fan of milk, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, that's fair enough. We do have lemon and we have sugar. We always have lots of sugar.
That's good.
Would you like a slice of apple tart to go with it?
I would love a slice of apple tart.
Oh, I'm so glad. I could never fully trust somebody who turns down the offer of a slice of apple tart.
Very wise. Very wise.
No, you don't mind the chickens over there, do you? They won't bother you. You're not allergic to chickens or anything.
I love chickens.
Oh, good. Yes, they seem to like you as well. Maybe they can just pick up on the positive vibes. So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
What I've brought with me is an antique compass.
Ooh.
It's a French compass. It's brass with the usual compassy things on them, which I picked up in Shoreditch Market.
Oh, why does this remind me of an Only Fools and Horses storyline?
Well, yeah, I somehow don't think it's going to make my fortune.
So what was it about it that attracted you?
When I've been paid for something, I've always, some writing or something, I've always bought a thing with the money. It doesn't matter whether it's just a cheap thing or something quite expensive, so long as it's a thing. So when the money's finally spent and everything's forgotten about, I can say this is the thing which this project bought me.
Mm-hmm.
For the first collection that I ever published, I bought a sort of little Perspex paperweight.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back in the 70s. And I still have this Perspex paperweight, and I can look at it and say that I bought that with the first money I ever earned from writing.
Aww.
And the compass is, I bought it with some of the money from the sale of the television option to my Europe books.
Mm-hmm.
and I thought it was quite appropriate.
Helping you find your way?
Yes, try and make sure I don't get lost. Lost in France, anyway. It is a French compass.
Ah, wonderful. Well, hopefully, even though it's French, it will help with, you know, finding your way in other places. I'm hoping that magnetic fields are fairly universal.
It'll probably help me navigate my way through Brexit.
Oh, I don't think anything can. Oh, if only there was a magical compass that could help us navigate through that. That would be awesome.
Indeed, we must find it.
It's a quest.
Yes.
Yeah, I would very happily go and slay some dragons to find that. But alas, I think it's probably just wishful thinking.
There is always hope.
Ah, yes. Yeah, in fact, my son said that yesterday, a conversation which I won't go into, which ended with him saying, but you have to have hope, Mama. All rebellions are built on hope. And we weren't even talking about rebellions. And it's like, excellent. That film has gone deep. Well done. So, there is always hope. Latimer, funnily enough, has a question. He would like to know why you're so cagey about the number of cats you own. He's wondering what you're hiding.
This is because the number of cats has changed down the years, and I haven't really updated my bio. We started out with two, then we had three, then we had two, then we had three, now we have one. It really is just laziness on my part for not updating the bio.
Ah, okay. Well, he'll probably be slightly disappointed and probably suspicious of such a harmless answer, but I will tell him it's the truth.
We don't have Schrodinger's cats.
So do you find that cats help the writing process or hinder?
It depends on the cat, really. The one we have at the moment sort of keeps himself to himself, really. He stays away from me unless he really wants something. Our previous cats were quite needy.
Oh.
And they would jump all over me. But that was nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it is with cats, isn't it?
Yeah, for a long time I didn't have any animals, and then we got these two cats, and I really can't imagine living without a cat now.
That's very sweet. I really wish we could have a cat, but I'm horrendously allergic to them.
Oh no!
Yeah, so I have to dose myself up with all the antihistamines known to mankind, and then I can have a bit of a cuddle, but I could never live with one.
Well, remind me never to give you a hug. I am sort of 80% cat hair by now.
I will bear that in mind.
I actually think that dark matter is actually cat hair.
Yeah, maybe so.
It's the thing that's holding the universe together.
That and gaffer tape.
Yes.
It has a light side and a dark side, and it holds the universe together.
Yes,
it's true. So I want you to imagine a very serious scenario in which Prince Adam of Eternia gives you his magic sword and asks you to look after it. Do you A, look after it as he's asked, B, hold it aloft, become He-Man and go and have fantastic adventures, or C, sell it to Skeletor?
I think I'd probably sell it to Skeletor. I'm always short of money.
So would you ask for just money, or would you be hoping for something else as well, like land or favours? Or
Money will do. Well, I'm not greedy, so long as it's a lot of money.
A lot of money. Okay, yeah. I think that Latimer is going to forgive you for not keeping your bio updated.
Really?
Yeah, I think he's probably warming up to you already. Oh, yes, I can see him nodding over there. Yes, I think he approves.
Hello, Latimer.
So I understand that you used to be a journalist. What kind of journalism?
Oh, I did all sorts of things. I did politics, I did crime, royal correspondenting at one point.
Blimey.
It's not as great as it sounds. I do feel sorry for the people who have to do it sort of day in, day out.
Mm, yes.
I've done pretty much everything apart from sports journalism.
So where do you think we are with journalism now? Because obviously there's been a huge amount of change just over the last 10 years in the world of journalism.
Yeah, it's changed beyond all recognition from when I was a boy journalist. I don't know. I think it's still in a process of flux, really. Things are still changing. I don't think things are quite shaken out yet.
Mm-hmm.
I do worry a little bit about this distrust of the media, which seems to be growing, which is, I think is fueled by politicians calling the news the fake news when it doesn't suit them.
Mm.
we do need a press and a media to hold power to account. And if we don't trust them, then politicians are just going to do what they want.
Yeah, I agree. But it is kind of hard when you have the press, well, elements of the press who are like hacking phones and doing absolutely awful things. I think that's been a contributing factor as well.
It is. And this is why I say I think things are still have not settled down yet. I mean, I would like to think that when things have settled down, we will have a more trustworthy press. We will feel that we can trust the press. I fear maybe we won't.
How do you think that it's going to... I mean, good grief, this is one hell of a question, because who the hell knows? But I'm just thinking that obviously one of the major factors involved in the shake-up of journalism over the past 10 years has been the internet. Do you think that journalism, as we have known it in the past, and the internet will be able to find a way to coexist peacefully in the future?
That's a really big question. I honestly don't know. It'll be interesting to see, and I hope I live long enough to see what sort of form it takes in the end. I think there will be a coexistence, but I suspect that sort of internet journalism, what we were calling citizen journalism a few years ago, will overwhelm traditional journalism because it's cheap.
Yes.
The problem with it being cheap is it's also less trustworthy.
Yes. And citizen journalism can't necessarily do the really important work like keeping track of the politicians and holding them to account. It may not be able to do that as effectively.
No, I think you have to have some kind of institution behind you to be able to do that, some kind of weight. I don't know. We're in a process of terrible change at the moment, and I put the news on every morning and my jaw drops.
Yes.
At something that the President of the United States has said, or some of the madness that's going on with Brexit. It's impossible to say how things are going to go. It's an interesting time, but it's still a bit scary.
It feels like interesting times, like the Chinese proverb.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
We are living in interesting times, and yes, it is awful in many respects.
It's true, yes.
But it's one of those strange things, isn't it? Because if you look at various metrics, there has been no better time for humanity. You know, we're living longer, we're actually having fewer wars. It doesn't feel that way, but there is less active warfare apparently going on than there has ever been before. And lots of other metrics suggesting that, you know, we are lifting ourselves out of very bad times that we've had previously. But it really feels to me like there are many people in the press and in politics who don't want us to think that or believe that. Do you have that impression, or do you think there's something else at work?
I think there's a, certainly for politicians, there's an interest in scaring the public.
Mm.
They will say, oh, crime figures are up, but we'll fix it. And I think there are elements of the press which back that up. If we were living in the period of the Hundred Years' War, we would really be hating things right now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, we're living, I guess, I mean, I was born in 1960, and compared to those times, we're pretty much living in a golden age.
Mm.
We are all relatively better off. We've got plenty to eat, if we can afford it, of course. But, you know, we all still have the same problems. We all still have troubles in our personal lives, and there is always something bad going on in the world. I reference again the President of the United States.
It is just like a constant daily, oh God, what has he done now? And funny enough, we, as in Pete and I, are watching The West Wing. We've never seen The West Wing before.
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it, but it's really interesting watching it now and watching something which is very positive about the institution of the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's portrayed as a very positive and heroic figure. And the juxtaposition of that and Trump, and watching CJ, who I adore and is my favourite character, and comparing her to Sean Spicer.
Sean Spicer, yes, I know, I've done it myself.
It's just like, what?
I watch him sometimes doing sort of press conferences, and I do think of CJ, and really he doesn't compare at all. I sometimes think that, you know, in about 8 months' time, he'll just crack in the middle of a press conference and tear all his clothes off and just start screaming.
I shouldn't laugh.
No, we shouldn't, really.
We shouldn't, because I really do, you know, worry that there are many people currently in DC who are probably on the brink of a nervous breakdown, and that is no laughing matter, but my God, it's just, it actually makes me feel really sad watching it now, watching The West Wing, and thinking, good grief. Yeah, compared to what we have now, this kind of circus that it is playing out, it's so tragic.
I think this is one of the problems. We watch things like The West Wing and House of Cards, and we get an impression of our politicians as being very capable and Machiavellian and clever, and really they're not. The impression I get at the moment is they're a bunch of buffoons, to be honest with you. Mm. All of them. They're not Machiavellian or capable. Certainly Trump is not.
No.
Trump is an overgrown child.
I keep thinking about what the world would be like if several key men had had therapy at really critical points in their lives.
Yes.
The world would be a better place if various men had sorted out father issues, and Hollywood films would be better.
Exactly,
well.
yes. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, it's quite scary. I kind of think we have to believe that the majority of them are incompetent, because if they were doing this knowingly and purposefully, that would be even more terrifying in some respects. That would be pure evil.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I prefer to believe that they are just incompetent.
Yeah. Scary times.
Yes, they are very scary. But I think the world needs now is President Bartlett.
Yeah, but he doesn't exist.
No, this is the problem.
But you know, I've been giving this a lot of thought lately, because over the past kind of year, well, ever since bloody Brexit, obviously, I've had many conversations in tears in my house, despairing at how awful things are and how terrible things are. And I got to the point where I thought, well, shit, I'm just going to have to do something, because I can't contain this rage anymore.
Yeah.
And so I've been starting to learn about local politics and thinking about getting involved. But the more I've been learning about how it all works, the more I'm realizing that I am fundamentally unsuitable for any kind of life intersecting with politics in an active way.
I think there is a certain mindset.
Yes.
There are some people who are wired for politics, but most people aren't.
And that's what worries me, because if you have a power structure which favours a particular type of self-selecting group of people, and they don't necessarily have the skills that intersect well with kind of governing well, as doing well in the media and winning elections, then we have a massive problem.
Exactly. I mean, this is the old saying that the only person who's actually fit to be the president is the person who absolutely does not want to be the president.
Yes. I don't know what we do about this.
I'll make a note. I may write a story about that.
I think there's probably going to be quite a few political stories born at this period of time.
I was talking to somebody the other night, and they were saying, you know, this would make a great plot for a book. And I said, well, you know, if I'd written a pitch based on the 4 months of the Trump presidency so far, I'd have been thrown out into the street.
Yes. Yes, and it's so true, isn't it? I saw a great tweet the other day with someone saying something like, my feelings go out to all of the dystopian writers who are trying to create this current time.
It is very hard to keep up.
Yeah,
it is.
It's
very hard to keep up.
And that's the other thing that's made me laugh with The West Wing, is that they talk about news cycles that are actually within time periods that we can actually keep track of, whereas now in the Trump era, the news cycle seems to be like every 45 minutes at the moment.
Somebody else that tweeted last night said it's not a news cycle anymore, it's an episode of Battlestar Galactica where the Cylons attack every 30 minutes. And it does feel like that, yes.
Oh my God, I love that so much. Oh, and that's an awesome episode, isn't it? The first Battlestar Galactica. Is it 33 minutes it's called?
I think so, yeah.
If someone's listening who hasn't watched it, please watch it. It's awesome.
It is one of the best things ever done on television.
Oh, I'm so glad you think that, yes.
I even forgive it the ending.
Yes, and that's, yeah, because I had so much goodwill towards it. It was like, okay, I still love you.
I thought it was a tremendously cheeky ending, and I admire it You know, they had a lot of guts to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have gone kind of safe route and just sort of ended it nicely. But I thought that took a lot of courage to do that, and I salute them for it.
Yeah, I've been struggling to find television series that kind of maintain quality. Is there something you've watched recently where you thought, yes, they started well, they kept it up, and they nailed the landing as well?
I've been very taken recently with Stargate Universe.
I haven't seen that. What's that like?
I really like it. There is a kind of Battlestar Galactica feel to it. It's a lot darker. The characters are a lot more complex than you get in the other Stargate franchises. Unfortunately, it only ran for two series, so it didn't kind of have an ending.
Oh.
But I liked it a lot. I think there was some very good writing and, you know, acting in it.
Have you seen Yord, Scott?
I have not. What is that?
Oh.
Are we talking Scandi crime here?
No, well, you think that's what it is. That when you watch the first episode, you think, oh, yeah, that's what this is. And oh my God, no, it isn't. It's the best rabbit hole experience. The less you know, the better. And obviously this being something that people listen to, that the spelling is J-O-R-D-S-K-O-T-T, if memory serves. And there may be an umlaut somewhere, I'm not sure. I hope I've got the right terminology.
Oh, we'll look it up.
Yeah, it's absolutely marvellous. I think it's 8 episodes, and it's one of the rare shows where I've absolutely fallen in love with not only the characters, but the plot. It's just so deftly written. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's incredible television. So I've got a question about the Clark Award ceremony and how you coped with the lead up to it. I'm asking for a friend.
Many congratulations, by the way. Many congratulations.
Thank you. But seriously, how did you cope with it? Because, like, I'm already losing sleep and it's months away.
Oh, I just assumed it wasn't going to win.
Well, I have exactly the same feeling.
I always assume it wasn't going to win.
But did you have a process in your mind where you think, there's no way I'm going to win? And then there's a little voice that goes, but what if you did? And
no.
Then you just kind of spiral into a total panic.
I was always certain that the books weren't going to win.
Okay.
I had in my head that I knew who was going to win. The first time I was wrong. I was certain that Claire North's book, The First 15 Lives of Harry August, was going to win. Because I thought that was a marvellous book. And Station 11 won. But the last time I was going around saying to everybody, yes, it's going to be Adrian Tchaikovsky or it's going to be Becky Chambers. And I was sort of, on the evening, I was going sort of poking Adrian in the chest and saying, you're going to win, you're going to win. And he was going, no, of course I'm not. And finally he did, which was great.
There was the biggest cheer in our household when he won. It was it was just so wonderful. I'm really sorry saying that because obviously you were up for the gong as well. But
I wasn't expecting to win. This is the thing. I was absolutely chuffed for Adrian. He's a lovely bloke and the book's very, very, very good.
Mm.
I thought he was a deserving winner.
Yes, and I couldn't agree more. And that's not just because he's an excellent GM and he's run me like the best ever D&D campaign ever in the world, so I'm slightly biased. He's an excellent writer.
Just enjoy the ride. You're going to the ceremony, I hope.
Yes.
So I'll see you there. Just enjoy the evening.
Yes. Top of my list is to not projectile vomit. The other things I worry about.
It is the most enormous fun.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So moving hastily on, I have a question from a patron of ours, the lovely Paul Weimer. And his question to you is, after breaking up Europe and so effectively managing the tricky subject of near future SF, what prompted you with your forthcoming novella to make the jump into space opera, a very different beast of a genre?
Tor.com had an open submissions period for space opera novellas, and I don't write a lot of space opera. You'll understand why when you read the book. but I just fancied having a try at it. And I had something which was sort of, I don't know, a third finished. And I thought, well, I'll finish this and send it off and see if they like it. Nothing to lose. And I was very fortunate. They agreed to publish it.
Fantastic.
So really, it's just a case of I just fancied going in for the open submission. There was no conscious career move or anything.
It wasn't that you were absolutely sick to death of near-future SF and needed a palate cleanser or anything like that.
Well, it was fun to do. It was a change, and that's always good. But no, I didn't feel like I wanted to, you know, just put everything else aside.
So are you going to stick with near-future SF, or are you currently flirting with any other genres?
Yes, I am. For the foreseeable future, and I can't foresee very far, yes, I'll be sticking with near future SF. I've got another Europe book to write. I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of messing around with a couple of other ideas for future books.
You see, I find it really fascinating, the whole thing of writing near future SF. I am quite intimidated by that. Do you just give yourself permission to not try to predict anything, or do you actively try to make predictions and then write them?
I think we've seen with current events how dangerous it is to try and predict anything.
Yes.
So no, I just sort of write the stuff which seems entertaining. Yeah, you know, I write stuff that I'd like to read. Mm-hmm. I'm not in the business of predicting stuff, thank God.
No, I really, really do feel for those people. It's like that tweet for dystopian writers, you know. I feel for the futurologists and the people who are paid to try and predict where things are going to go.
I did a short story once that was set a few years from now. I did predict the fall of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall, but I kind of thought that the Berliners would keep part of the Berlin Wall, or quite a large part of the Berlin Wall, as a memorial to human stupidity. And I never expected them to sort of knock the whole thing down. So there are little things like that. Mm. You know, you can kind of overthink yourself. The story is the most important thing, rather than, you know, prognosticating.
I mean, I don't necessarily mean that you're trying to make a firm prediction, but when you're developing your ideas for near future SF, do you start with the current day and say, okay, I think logically this could happen, or do you just totally just let yourself imagine whatever you want to imagine? Is there a current day starting point in your process?
No, I think it's a case of sort of retrofitting everything. You know, you have the idea for something, and then you kind of go back and backstop it with stuff that you know now.
That's really interesting.
So you have a point 70 years from now, and you think, I want it to be like that, and then you think, well, how could we get there from here, if you see what I mean, rather than saying this is where things are now, what could happen.
I love that, because I love hearing how different authors approach these things in such a variety of ways, and how it just totally underscores that point that there is no correct way to approach any of this.
No, there isn't. There is no right way to write.
No.
And there is no wrong way to write. Everybody does it differently.
And hooray for that.
Yes, absolutely.
So something I like to ask friends who come to take tea with me is, if you could choose a theme tune for your life, what would it be? Because the chickens over there that look very calm and normal are actually incredibly talented musicians. So I was wondering what you would choose as the theme tune for your life.
I'm tempted to say something really evil, like something by Sisters of Mercy.
Why is that evil?
All right. This Corrosion by Sisters of Mercy.
Oh, marvellous.
Which I think is an absolutely marvellous song.
It really is. It's a true classic.
It's one of the great songs, and you turn it up loud, and it's so far over the top that it can't even see the top anymore. It's a wonderful thing.
It is. Oh, if I had a pound for every time I danced badly to that song, well, I could fix the Brexit problem, let's put it that way. Okay then, little chickens, please could you sing This Corrosion by the Sisters of Mercy for Dave, please? There they go.
Oh, bless. That is the most extraordinary thing I have ever heard. Seriously, there should be a new musical genre for that kind of thing.
Yeah, do you think so? Maybe yes. A Hugo category.
Chicken Goth.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, a Spotify channel. So what can fans look forward to seeing from you next? Is the novella the next thing to come out?
The novella is the next thing. It's called Acadie, and it's out from tor.com on September the 5th.
Ah, oh, marvellous.
And then there is something else coming out, which I can't really talk about yet.
Ooh.
In June, I think, or sometime next summer. Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed, if I get a move on, the fourth Europe book will be coming out in the autumn next year.
Excellent.
Fourth and final Europe book, I hesitate to say.
And it's definitely the final one?
Absolutely. Mm. Unless I have another idea.
Mm. Whenever anyone says that, I always think of that Simpsons with Krusty the Clown, where they're like, "Krusty, how could you do this?" And he's like, "They drove a dump truck of money up to my house. What was I going to do?" So whenever an author says it's definitely the last book, I always imagine someone driving a dump truck of money up to their house.
Oh, if only. I would write Europe books the rest of my life if there were dump trucks of money coming. Seriously. I'm coming across as terribly venal here. I'm not really like that.
No, no one will think you are. It'll be fine. Anyway, we know that you're a decent chap because you like Sisters of Mercy and you like apple tart. So, you know, you're beyond reproach.
I have those things in my favour. That's true.
Well, let me just check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. So all that's left for me to say is thank you so much for coming and joining me in the tea there today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
I will be seeing you in July. I say seeing you. I'm just going to be a wreck. So I may just quiver at you.
Just enjoy yourself.
I'll try. But it's that whole thing of being in public. This is a baseline, that's quite tough.
So, yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things. But fingers crossed that we will be able to have fun and whatever happens, and that nobody would be sick.
I'll be rooting for you anyway.
Thank you. I'll be trying not to be ill.
Well, I hope you're not.
I'll be rooting for my gut.
I quite like the shortlist this year. There's a nice mix of stuff.
Yes, I agree. Okay, right. I'm going to try not to think about that now. So if you just follow Latimer, he'll show you the way back out of the library, and I will see you at the end of July.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Yes, I look forward to seeing you too. Take care now.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
That was nice. Latimer, I've been meaning to ask, what's that thing over there? It seems familiar.
That's the librarian, ma'am.
The librarian is a robot?
Yes, ma'am. Recycled from old parts of Episode 5.
I beg your pardon?
After the disastrous incident with Mr. Bradley, I had the MAL 1000 rebuilt as a librarian. It functions quite well, and without violence, provided it does not come into contact with anyone called Dave.
But Latimer, our guest is called Dave.
Actually, ma'am, I think you'll find our guest is called David.
Actually, Latimer, I think you'll find that my fist is about to...
Dave. Stop, Dave.
Oh, he's not letting him leave. And what do all those flashing lights mean?
Ah, that pattern means that Mal has identified something that has been misfiled. I believe he is about to put Mr. Hutchinson in his proper place.
But he's not a book. He writes them.
You say potato.
And he won't fit on the shelf.
Mal is very resourceful and strong. And stubborn. Eventually, I'm sure Mr. Hutchinson will squish down like all the others.
I'm afraid I can't let you do that, Dave.
Dave's whispering something into Mal's microphone. Oh, and all of the lights have changed colour. What does that mean?
I'm not sure, ma'am. Mal is either confused, or about to self-destruct, or possibly both.
Stop. You're hurting me, Dave. Dave. Please. Dave. Dave. Stop. Stop. Dave. Stop.
Ah, Mal's stopped, and now Dave can slip away safely.
If you'll excuse me, ma'am, I'm just going to go and see what Mr. Hutchinson did to poor Mal 1000.
While Latimer is attending to the robot librarian, I would like to raise my teacup to Carl, the newest member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. And, seeing as Latimer is distracted, it's the perfect opportunity to let you know that the fifth and final novel in the Split World series, All Good Things, will be out in June and is available for pre-order now from all the usual places. Ah, Latimer, did you manage to work out what Dave did?
It appears that Mr. Hutchinson said something that led Mal 1000 to question the nature of reality and trapped it within a logical paradox, which in turn led to a full system shutdown.
Heavens to Betsy! But what did he actually say?
Ah, I'll whisper it to you, Mom.
But what? Well, if that's true, then how do we know if anything is real? How? No, why? Who?
Oh, dear.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.